What's up, Parish Orphans and Retrogrades? Timothy Gordon bringing you a show today on why I left academia with Dr. Michael Robillard. It's not about me. It's about my friend, Dr. Michael Robillard, who is a former Army officer. He's a former academic philosopher. He's a very interesting dude. I'd like to introduce you right now. What's up, Michael? How are you?
Hey, Tim. How's it going? Yeah, thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate you inviting me on. And it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you've got a hugely fascinating tale. First off, you're a tough dude. I think people would like to hear, for starters, before they hear why you left academia, maybe why you got into academia, how you did, what happened there, how you left your role as an Army officer, and the way things proceeded from there. Can you just give us a sort of opening? Who is Michael Robillard, really?
Right. Yeah. I grew up in a small town south of Boston from a very Irish Catholic sort of labor left kind of family. Very sort of JFK Democrat. Really believed in faith, family, flag, and service to the country. Ended up going to West Point when I was 17. Got into philosophy while I was there because I was concerned about things like theology and reality and ethics. And, that some of the questions there started chipping away or planting some seeds of doubt with respect to Catholic canon. Nonetheless, I still had a believer's commitment. And I would say that all sort of got existentially smashed somewhere in the streets of Baghdad in 2003, 2004. And, at least in terms of like in the actual tactical moments, and then coming back and hearing retrospectively that, the grounds for the war itself, with respect to trying to find these WMDs that Saddam had, right? That the justice behind that was specious as well, really added further doubt in my head as to this sort of stack of faith, family, and flag commitments. That weakened it as well, and it just made me begin doubting a little, like, well, what else that I had committed myself to is suspect. And around that same time, the culture, this is when the new atheists were really sort of blowing up, and that was really attractive. And then the culture at large was very MTV generation type stuff. And I got pulled into that framework, and then my march through academia for the next 15 years was me just essentially hunting or trying to rebuild some type of conceptual framework that made sense.
Yeah. So, okay. So you were at the time, streets of Baghdad, 2003, 2004, you're an Army officer, and you've tied together faith, family, flag. And so you fall away from the Roman Catholic faith because you're essentially tying it to, flag, I guess. And of course, now you're a reverted Catholic. You've come back to the faith. This is all, it all seems to be tied together like a bundle of sticks. You went to academia as a sort of repudiation of your days in the Army, or how would you characterize that?
I mean, somewhat, I think like I went into academic philosophy in the area of normative ethics and just war theory. So we're still sorting through, what is the justice of going to war, and what is just behavior look like in war, right? So I didn't fall too far afield from those concerns. But underpinning it all, right, is that you see these folks like a Sam Harris or a Peter Singer or Richard Dawkins, where they'll say, the evolutionary objective science disproves God and it disproves ethics. It's just raw atheist materialism. Therefore, animal rights. Therefore, cosmopolitanism. Therefore, workers' rights. And it's like, no, that it doesn't work, right? It's you can't just pull an ought out of an is, right? But that's what they do, right? They use evolutionary science to bulldoze a Christian framework. And then they're left with just the is claims. And then they pull out and they go, oh, therefore, universal human rights, we need to have the UN, you know, regulate all these things, right? The Declaration of Human Rights. And it's like that doesn't just magically drop out of these is claims, right? It's like once you've hollowed out that ethics, Dostoevsky is actually correct, right? It's do anything, right? Anything's permissible, not atheist, materialist science, therefore humanism. That doesn't follow at all.
Yeah.
So, but it took me like 15 years to see, oh, that's like a huge fallacy that's occurring there.
Yeah, even if Pius the 12th is right and some account of evolution is correct, then how does one explain the generation of the universe? How does one account for the generation of life? I mean, on some iteration of evolution, you just explain, you know, one species becoming another, but this does nothing to account for the beginning of the universe, matter itself, space, time, life.
Yeah, any a priori claims about mathematics, logic, aesthetics, ethics, any robust odds don't drop out of science. You don't get science off the ground to begin with unless those things are already presupposed. So, that's not obvious with the sort of the pop culture, Neil deGrasse Tyson beating you over the head. Well, but the science says this, according to the science, right, there's some human rights molecules look at all the rights that are in here, according to the science. And it's no, you, what are you talking about? Right. There's, you can't just make that jump of the is-ought gap from brute science to robust odds. And this is where Sam Harris's Moral Landscape book is absolutely terrible in terms of that, that move, right? He bootstraps consequentialism out of neuroscience. It's like, okay, good luck. That's a fun ad hoc story. I'd like to hear how that happens.
Yeah. If God's not real, since you brought up Ivan Karamazov, Michael, if God's not real, then everything's permitted. That's the way you can complete that, that if then claim. If God's not real, it doesn't mean we shift from one set of Christian oughts to another set of animal rights, anti-Christian
oughts. It's just this ad hoc placeholder.
Yeah. So, okay. But I mean, so you, for you, just to round out your tale. So you're, you're a West Point graduate. You do a couple tours, right?
And just did one.
You just did one. Okay. So you're in Iraq. You go to academia to get your PhD. You've spent over a decade doing the academia game. You kind of just finished that game, right? And sometime over the course of that game, which according to what you're telling me right now, was itself a sort of perceived remediation of your disillusionment and disenchantment on the streets of Baghdad in 2003 and 2004. And now your course, over the last 5 years, 4 years, since 2017, you've been course correcting. Yeah, you have this article that you released that's great. I shared it, called "How I Left Academia" or "How Academia Left Me." Can you tell me the story of, like Ed Norton in American History X, when he starts noticing stuff isn't right with the white supremacists? You're coming the other direction.
Yeah. It's, I mean, this article, I should say, it was building up inside me, I would say, for like the last 3 years at least. And it's sat on my desktop for a long, long time. And I've been thinking about it, just trying to process it. And I would say that, I make it to Oxford. I make it to, the dream position that I was heading to. Right. It's like that doesn't really get much higher altitude than there. And I was doing stuff, really technical writing in the area of artificial intelligence and weaponized AI. And that was fine to do. like within that corridor of discourse, that's fine, right? Nerd out as technically as you want. But then the gender ideologue stuff came along, and me and other philosophers, some of which were Christians, some of which were just open-minded, left-to-center liberal secular philosophers, started to say, wait a second, this is some very loose and fast philosophy where people aren't defining their terms and they're running roughshod over the discussions, or they're shaming people and silencing them, and they're not even letting the arguments be fully explored. And the trouble is that when I got into philosophy, the selling point that a lot of people, my mentors and the discipline that I came up in, was the argument was that this is analytic philosophy, right? We're doing conceptual analysis from premises to conclusions, right? Define your terms, set up your argument, and we're going to run the argument from first principles, armchair first principles. These are premises. These are your starting positions. What are the, you know, crank the handle. What are the logical entailments?
Right.
As opposed to what is, you know, broadly referred to as continental philosophy, or, you know, sometimes postmodern philosophy. I mean, continental is obviously broader than postmodern stuff, but all your queer theory and Africana Caribbean studies theory and women's studies and LGBT stuff, that was always laughed at by the analytic philosophers. And it was always dismissed as, well, look, that's not what we do. That's what the lit crit department does. That's what these amateurs in anthropology and sociology do.
Yeah.
They're terrible at defining the terms. Let the sociologists and the anthropology folks, let them talk in circles about that stuff. We're doing hardcore analytic philosophy here. That was the beginning of my grad school experience. I would say somewhere at the beginning, 2015 or so, right? This is when you start seeing like intersectionality and critical race theory beginning to seep out of academia and out of these departments more into analytic philosophy proper. And then in 2017, LGBT, intersectionality, critical race theory, they bust out of quarantine and form Rainbow Voltron and march through the academy into mainstream society and into the market. And here we are now, right? So I would say it was a blistering speed at which these fringe ideas that weren't even taken seriously by analytic philosophers were able to run roughshod right through the academy into the mainstream with little, if any, resistance by the supposed analytic first principles armchair folks.
Yeah, right? I want to talk about that point. I want to talk about a logarithmic function that happened between the advent of feminism, the advent of the homo theories, and then the advent of tranny stuff. But let's get to that in half a second. A few plugs here. One, you're running a big event in Georgia on September 11th that, you know, I'll be supporting in one way or another. I might make an appearance there. You're having names like Roosh and Michael Voris will be there, and others. So it'll be a veterans event that I'll talk some about in the run up to that. Also, something that me and you talked about in Notre Dame a few weeks ago was the idea of getting from blue states to red states. I support an outfit called realestateforlife.org. It's helped many, many good Christian folks get from blue states to red states. It's a big part of the push. What I'm supporting ideologically is a kind of balkanization movement where we real right-wingers get in the same place, form better res publicas, small is beautiful, meaning state and city level government. And then we go from there, you know. So go to Real Estate for Life, folks, parish orphans and retrogrades out there, because they can help you get out of your blue state to a red state. The main comment I'm getting is people are surprised how much help their receiving from Real Estate for Life and how easy it is to move states. A lot of people did it. Michael just moved from Notre Dame. I just moved here to Mississippi. You moved to the South. It's a good place to be, somewhere between Texas and Florida. And there are several reasons for that. Go to realestateforlife.org. Finally, get your kids not only out of college, you know, right? We were joking about this beforehand, like, don't go to college. We could talk maybe more about that in a little bit, but also don't send your kids to school. Homeschool your kids, people. This is the best way to do it. They're teaching them transgender garbage in the public schools and even in a lot of the Catholic schools. Proto-transgenderism, i.e. feminism, at least in the Catholic schools. So educate them at home. And if you do that, then I will help you. A lot of people are intimidated to begin, and it's quite easy. It's needless intimidation. If you go to timothyjgordon.com, we have a retrograde classical academy up. We can help you run the classes for you in classes like Latin 1 for your kids, Algebra 1, higher level stuff as well, church history, American history, Aristotle, still offering some of the courses we have over the past year. Go to timothyjgordon.com and begin homeschooling your kids this fall. Okay. Plugs now out of the way. Michael, here's something I wanted to point out. The logarithmic curve, when we note a heightening between the generation of the movement's feminism, which is, I know for you, the transgenderism thing was the big tell, but mm-hmm. feminism is underneath it, right? It's mm-hmm. feminism, then the homo movement, then the tranny movement. Feminism took about 100 years to cook, right? From about the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848 to about about 1950. It's about 100 years, right? And then it got going, you know, in the 50s, and it took 20 years to really mobilize. And then you have 1970 when all these propagandized mothers are shamed into leaving what you know, a wife is supposed to do, stay at home, raise the kids, and they get shamed to go work crappy $11 an hour jobs, you know, wearing pumps and business suits, but they're just some other man's secretary. And
it's a Chesterton quote. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. What is it? Do you have that offhand? That's a good quote.
Something like, feminism is the muddled idea that women are liberated by working for another man instead of their husband.
Yeah.
Exactly. Something like that. Right. And it's like you're just shifting what patriarchal system you're opting into. Yeah.
That's right. A good one versus a maleficent one.
Soulless
one. Exactly. That took about 100 years. Yeah. Then you note the gay stuff really cooked for about 10 years, you know, as order of magnitude of 10 less. It was really beginning, if you watch early Seinfeld, early Frasier's in the kind of early to mid 90s, 93, 94, they're starting to really put more homo type characters into each episode. And that cooks for a while. And then you get, you know, Prop 8 becomes a big struggle in the mid 2000s. So, you know, it's closer to 10 years, 10, 12 years. So you go from 100 year cook time for feminism, the mother philosophy, and feminism is the original sin, right? That feminism is the original canard that Satan played on to fool human beings into the fall. So it's a really big deal. I talk about this a lot in my upcoming book, Case for Patriarchy. Feminism, then an iteration of it, homosexualism. Feminism is basically men, women acting like men and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Homosexualism is men and women being so fooled that they can act like men and women that they do so in the bedroom, right? Mm-hmm. And then closer to like 1 year was the cook time, another order of magnitude of 10, much quicker, more aggressive, was the mid 20 teens, you know, 2015, 2016, boom, all of a sudden that had 1 year of basting. Whereas feminism had taken about 100, homosexualism had taken about 10. Now we're down another 10th, and it's like 1 or 2 years of basting. And then all of a sudden 2017, everyone's just like, oh, you know what? Today I'm feeling a little cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Call me a lady today. What? what are you talking about? Right. Why did this happen so fast?
Yeah, you're right. It is picking up exponential speed. And you ever listen to the Babylon Bee? Did you ever watch that?
Oh yeah.
There's some interview they did with a guy who runs that recently. And he said something like, it's hard to do satire anymore because reality is it's weirder than satire. So it becomes difficult to tell when someone's doing satire versus what the actual news article is. And yeah, you're right. I mean, it's where we're presently at now. We've went from like the toleration of a particular fringe thing to normalization to celebration to almost mandatory acceptance or something like that. I mean, I think I've looked at this so far. I think you have June is Pride Month. September is LGBT Awareness Month. And then I think there's something like 30 other holidays scattered throughout the year. So what, one quarter of our calendar of how we chop up our rhythm of the year is dominated by these presumed marginalized groups. And it's like, at what point do you say, it doesn't look like you're when I'm giving you one quarter of the calendar, it doesn't sound like you're marginalized, right? It sounds like you're the dominant orthodoxy now. And so it's went from tolerance to moderation to mandatory acceptance. And with respect to the gender stuff, like it's not merely like, okay, well, we should be tolerant of persons that have same-sex attraction or something like that. It's that a person can merely speak a claim into the world, and that every other proposition that the world is committed to include scientific commitments, historical commitments, all linguistic claims, all institutions must pivot around that fixed point of this person's moment-by-moment prerogative. And that's a rights claim that they have, right? And it amounts to essentially, I have a rights claim that the objective world is what I say it is.
Right.
And it's like, I'm afraid that's not a rights claim. You can't have a rights claim for something that's impossible. And I can't have a corresponding duty to accord with that impossible claim. It turns out reality just pushes back. And it doesn't mean that you're being oppressed. You're just running into objective reality. That's all it is.
Yeah, I remember when, as a cradle conservative, I'm a cradle Catholic, but one that fell away and had to revert like you. But I was a cradle conservative, I guess, unlike you. And I've been using Emperor's New Clothes, the little boy in Emperor's New Clothes who just takes everyone to task, reminds everyone starkly of reality.
Right.
Like King is Nick. I've been using this for a long time, but it's much more apropos of what began to happen in 2016, 2017 with transgenderism than any other possible implementation of it. Right. I mean, like, you can always say, hey, the left is crazy. They always have been. Your big issue is transsexualism. I think abortion is the ultimate sort of Emperor's New Clothes issue. But in some sense, it's more funny. It's more funny and fitting in regard to what's been going on the last 5 years with transgenderism, because it's more close to what's happening. It's like a stage. There will be some transsexual saying, look at me, aren't I a beautiful woman? It's like, you're not beautiful. You're not a woman. You're this, really pitiable creature. That's utterly confused. You got 5 o'clock shadow. You look like a circus clown, and you have all of these just befuddled hoi polloi, just like the Emperor's New Clothes. We're like, yes, you're beautiful. Yeah. It's like the people that whoever these people are behind the scenes that encourage the awful performers on American Idol to go on and continue and embarrass themselves.
Right. Yeah.
Except there's no more embarrassment because they've befuddled all of the masses, all 99.9% of them, into saying, yes, this is a beautiful woman.
Yeah, I think Matt Walsh made this point really well, where he said it's effectively female blackface when you look at it, right? It's this caricature of this exaggerated, essentialized female qualities being put on by a man. And it's like, well, isn't this, where are all the feminists that have pushed the, yeah, I, that's another thing I'm surprised at is that the number of third wave feminists that have fought so hard ostensibly for their own rights claims and then have just completely bent the knee to a guy with a beard walking into their spaces and saying, I'm a woman now. I'm all the things that you have fought for. I'm helping myself to that and I'm taking it over. And it's like, and they just go, okay, well, welcome sister. And it's like,
yeah.
Which, do you really believe that? I mean,
it's delightful. It's delightful because they finally did it to themselves. Like Steve Martin tells John Candy in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, he's like, you finally did it to yourself. You're always doing it to me. The right, we're usually the putzes that blow a 20-point fourth quarter lead, yep. Right? You know, and by that, I mean, we have the right ideas and we still manage to lose. We're losers, Christians and conservatives. We're freaking losers, right? We lose, the left always wins, even though they have bad ideas. But they finally fumbled the ball, even though this should have been an easy run in for a touchdown. It's literally like feminists who are the ultimate enemy. The feminism is the big game. It is leftism simplicitaire. Feminism is the non serviam of Eve in the garden. You know, Eve is the one who committed the original sin, not Adam. It is the diabolic I will not serve. But they allowed a Trojan horse in the door with the transsexuals, right? Because like you say, they ushered them in and now it's like, okay, well, if you let a man who's dressed in what used to be called drag, an imaginary woman, into your midst, you're going to get destroyed in sports. And I'm not a supporter of female sports, right? I think it's hilarious. Karsten Brash, number 200 ranked, a male tennis player, you know, drinks a beer, then destroys both Williams sisters in one day, you know, because they thought they could beat him.
The MMA fighter Fallon Fox fractured the skull of a female MMA fighter with a Thai knee clinch. And that doesn't happen very much. MMA, to be able to fracture someone's skull with a knee. I think it's happened one other time. And yeah, this is, hey, well, how did she do it? What were her training methods? His training methods was he just declared himself a woman and then marched into a cage and beat an actual woman senseless. And yeah. we applaud this as... This is the apex of human achievement, right? This is the onwards and upwards we go. This is what we want. This is what a virtuous, flourishing society ought to look like. And it's aesthetically, if anything, like you don't even need the arguments. I mean, aesthetics alone should be
right
demonstrable of that we've somewhere went astray.
Right. Right. Let me read from a little bit from your article because I think this is good. You said I was compelled so much by these philosophical questions and ideas that I would later be moved to terminate what was at the time a fruitful career as a U.S. Army officer, to turn down several lucrative white collar jobs thereafter, and to shove all my chips into the center of the playing table in hopes of one day becoming a professional analytic philosopher. Now, after a decade of being within the ivory tower, of seeing how the sausage is made and witnessing firsthand the business that academia really is, I've determined quite sadly that the discipline of academic philosophy and the university system more generally has become little more than an indoctrination center for woke leftist ideology and the antithesis of its original aim and purpose. That being said, this essay is my explanation of how and why I'm leaving academia, or more appropriately, how academia ended up leaving me. What I'm wondering, Michael, is like, I want to push you a little on this. Did academia really leave you? I mean, the real child murder, right? En masse child murder, abortion, which academia has always supported. Both of our lives were like almost the exact same age. It's been there. There's been enthusiastic support for abortion in all of the institutions aside from the church. All of the institutions were stormed for like the 70s, 80s, 90s. And transgenderism is maybe the weirdest looking, mm-hmm. whereas the child murder, the little genetic human murder, infanticide that goes on in our midst, you know, 5 miles from our door at Planned Parenthood, it does happen silently. So it's not as in your face as some giant dude threatening Ben Shapiro, you know, call me a woman or else.
Right.
So it's a little less bizarre looking, but academia has been the major exponent of calling child murder abortion rights and that kind of thing. So did it really leave you, or is it just that you're on one end, went to another extreme, kind of came back to not center, but came back to maybe your senses because of the extremes of transgenderism, the as you say, aesthetic extremes? Or did it really leave you?
That's a really good question. And I guess maybe a bit of both. I don't know. The beginning of my grad school experience, I remember being in classrooms where it was a grad level classroom, and we had one open Thomist in there, one who is a Catholic but was very quiet about it, and other folks in the room who were a variety of center left secularists to maybe far left feminists. And we got along, and we respected one another, and we batted around ideas, and things got a bit chippy at times, but I do think that there was mutual respect, and there was a pluralistic agreeing of viewpoints. And it didn't seem so steeped in ideology, but you know, that's like 2012, and something shifted between then. I mean, I couldn't tell you when. You know what I mean? It's the classic sororities paradox of, you know, you keep adding a grain of sand, and at some point it becomes a heap, and it's a grain of sand isn't equivalent to a heap, but at some point it changes into a heap, and you can't really place exactly where or when, but it did.
No. Without a doubt. I'm pushing a concept more than I'm pushing a sort of distinction of kind rather than the certainly correct distinction of degree you're making. I'm saying maybe in certain places, in certain corners of the academy, it was more civil. I mean, when I started grad school, it was 2004, and I was in Los Angeles at like Loyola Marymount, nominal Catholic university, and it was pretty far left then, and it was pretty aggressively against anything walking or talking like a real Catholic or a real conservative. So I don't remember too many particulars, but here's what I'm saying. Even if in 2011, 2012, you could get along with the pro-aborts in the room, and of course you were in a different ideological mind space then, but ought one to, right? Even if we could get along with the pro-aborts, you know, should we? I mean, this is what's going on behind the scenes. Are these people are toiling night and day for their sacred cow, which is abortion. This is the one thing the left will, Nancy Pelosi's insinuated as much. They will wage revolution if the Supreme Court starts talking about undoing the most superlative grave injustice in American history of Roe versus Wade. If they start talking that, the left will, they won't allow it. They're Baphomet worshipers. You know, it's Luciferianism. Child sacrifice is at the center of what they do. And should we even want to get along with them? Like, it's an aspiration.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a question of maybe principle versus method. And, you know, some folks might... might be more amenable to hearing these arguments if they're met halfway with you know, reasoned discourse as opposed to to sort of just closing off the dialogue. As far as I'm concerned, I think it's conceptually within the left, what needs to be like really pointed out is that they help themselves to, well, the injustices of slavery were helping the Black community, but then somehow, how are you helping the Black community? But when, you know, Margaret Sanger is, you know, the founder of Planned Parenthood that essentially had a eugenics program against the Black community and incentivizing that. So I think it's like, if you could decouple those things by saying, look, you know, voting left or being liberal, it's not helping the Black community because, you know, you're not scoring one for women's rights and helping the Black community. You're actually harming that community. And what needs, if you really do care about the Black community, then what they need is strong fathers, and they don't need the state that is cuckolding them. And right. And they don't need incentivized abortions. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of purchase to that argument, and I think it can be made. It could be made clearly and effectively. And I'd like to see that dialogue happen more before there's just a palm in the face, shut the door in the face. We're not even going to have a dialogue. I think that's at least where I stand right now.
Sure. I'm not trying to turn it into an abortion talk, but since it's the ostensible niceties of academia, what you're saying might be true if this were ever like a something that was up on the table for discussion, which the university never does, even in the days that were more civil that we're talking about, early 2000s, maybe through 2012. It still wasn't like, well, is abortion right or wrong? Let's have a Lincoln Douglas style debate on it. They'll never do that, right? They were just like, all the professors were pro-aborts. All the students were presumed to be pro-aborts. And if someone found out that you were anti-abortion back in 2011 or 2012, they might not dox you and try to ruin your life. That's what you're characterizing as the nice period. It still was never so reasonable as position neutral, let's see who has the better argument. If it were that, then I'd be with you. I'd be 100% with you. The problem, even, and it's a great way, if you have a listening ear and a willful mind, it's a great analogy, you know, the Margaret Sanger stuff. But my problem with it in principle is this: look, abortion's 1,000 times worse than slavery. I don't know, 100,000 times worse than slavery or something like that. Infinitely worse than slavery. So I'm not going to, it's part of me objects to analogizing to a way, way, way less bad crime just because the left, it's one of the crimes that for whatever reason, the left accepts as morally wrong, even though they're, you know, moral relativists. So part of me is like, okay, well, you know, if you have a willing kind of centrist leftist that'll hear you out and make these arguments. But on the other hand, it's like, this is obnoxious, right? This is 1,000 times worse than slavery. Why am I analogizing to slavery as if it's 1,000 times worse than abortion? We are literally a culture that eats up and spits out our kids in you know, Planned Parenthood. It is literally illegal for abortion to be made illegal on Roe versus Wade jurisprudence. And it seems to me that, well, you're totally right. I love your article. I wanted to read one more passage in it. the transsexualism stuff made this way more in your face. Some of the comments even that you're quoting from leftist professors are way more in your face. But abortion still got to be the big issue because it's the big human rights violation.
It is. And this gets back to this whole like cherry picking what our normative and epistemic principles are. It's like there are any number of leftist arguments, particularly with respect to like epistemic risk, right? Where you say, look, you know, I don't know, you know, there's like a really small likelihood that I know that this thing is bad. But like, if it is bad, it's a really, really, really bad thing. And that really is the Catholic viewpoint here, where it's just like, look, you know, don't you think that all things being equal, that if you're uncertain of whether it's a life or it's not, but if it is, you're committing, you're murdering your own kid. Doesn't that weigh in favor of not taking that risk, right? So like all these sort of like, well, what is the metaphysical status of the zygote, right? Isn't that indeterminate, blah, blah, blah. You could take that on board, but you know, it turns out that if it is a living being with a soul, if there's a small chance that it is, then like the gravity of what you've just done is catastrophic. And that should be that is a principle, this principle of weighing epistemic certainty with the severity of the good or the bad that is going to occur. That's, the left uses that all the time in other arguments with respect to like climate change or like whatever, pernicious artificial intelligence. Like why wouldn't that same normative epistemic trade-off apply to a fetus? And be, yeah, and you won't see an answer about that. You know, then they'll be like, oh, well, look over here. There's something else to you know, what's your theory of truth? What yeah. how do you know that you're not a brain in a vat? And it's like, let's stay on topic. Yeah.
They don't care about the epistemic certitude about the you know, psychological status of a zygote, right? Whether or not it's got a soul, because most analytic philosophers don't believe in souls anyway. None of the leftists we're really talking to believe in a soul in a real way. What they always claim to talk about is science, right? So the more fitting question to ask is, what's the biological status of a zygote? And it's beyond any doubt, right? It's, you got to follow the science. This is biologically human. You can't kill it. And they're like, well, yeah, it's biologically human, but then they want to pivot and use a UTEP two-step and start talking about the soul. It's like, well, you guys don't believe about in this in the first place, right? The people that do, the Roman Catholic Church, which built Western civilization, it built Europe, cryptically it built America. All of our common law is based on it, at least through Magna Carta. And yes, the Catholic Church, who's the ultimate expositor of the human soul, says, yes, this counts as a human soul anyway, but you guys don't believe in this. Let's just deal with it as a biological principle. Hey, I wanted to read this blurb from your excellent piece too. It says, more perplexing still, such folks often do so, having fully convinced themselves that they are somehow oppressed victims, scrappy underdogs speaking truth to power against impossible odds as part of some revolutionary underground resistance movement, while garnering support from nearly every major Western institution imaginable, from Hollywood to big business to the Queen of England to Oreo cookies. You're talking about SJWs who still talk as if they're underdogs. That's a great rhetorical technique they employ really effectively. I commend them on it. Yep. Always talk as if you're the underdog, even when you're the guy, the big bully on the block clobbering people. And of course they are. They've stormed all of the institutions of the West, as you point out, all the way up to Oreo cookies. You say Mark Bray, for instance, author of the Anti-Fascist Handbook, nearly openly calls for overt violence against anyone who disagrees with this group's political vision, while promoting his work on Amazon's bestseller list and enjoying the safety of a professorship at Rutgers. I love how even your sentences in this paragraph are structured, right? Where you're saying, look, he's saying that he's like a radical chic. He talks as if he's Che Guevara, you know, going around risking his life.
Well, welcome to the underground.
welcome to the underground. And then it's like,
if you're getting this communique, then we've somehow got through it.
Yeah, exactly. It's a cool aesthetic. It where even Mark Levin on the right's like, I'm broadcasting from an underground bunker. It's like, no, you're not. You're not, you know, you're tubby. You're comfortable. You eat very well. Yeah. You know, and so does this guy in his the safety of his professorship at Rutgers, as you call it. You say feminist journalist Lori Penny promotes her radical viewpoints, too disruptive and controversial for everyday consumption, at the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. Again, radical chic, officially sponsored by the Sydney Opera House and the City of Sydney. An LGBTQ philosopher, Rebecca Kokla, is able to tell her opponents on Twitter to suck her queer blank, direct quote, while maintaining a comfortable tenureship as senior research scholar of ethics at nominally Catholic Georgetown, while suffering zero professional backlash. Meanwhile, veteran suicide rates in this country get shoved behind a superficial veil of thank you for your service, but please someone stop the presses because quote unquote trans people are dying, whatever the hell that even means. Still, these folks are somehow the marginalized. Why is this such an important technique, always casting oneself as the marginalized even when they're the muscle?
So part of it, I would say, is narratively, you know, humans think often in terms of narrative structure, and who doesn't like a good underdog story, right? You know, everybody would like to think that they're on the side of they are the underdog, or they're the on the side of the underdog, and they want to see that narrative arc kind of come to completion. And so if you can tell that narrative, then, and you can tell it effectively, then political discourse ends up being almost downstream of that simple narrative. And it takes, I would say, either a real life moment or maybe a reconsideration of one's first principles to see, like, well, why, you know, is that actually correct? And for me, one of the things, it was a very visceral moment of seeing, it was a picture of, I don't know if you've seen it, was Jordan Peterson gave a talk somewhere in Toronto, I believe. And he was surrounded by this mob of screaming transgendered students that they just wanted to maul him, and he was just like, you know he's just calmly trying to explain to them just the principles of classical liberalism, and they're like, you know, shut up. And the aesthetic of that made me think, oh wait a second, maybe I'm not on the side of the scrappy underdogs anymore. Right.
Yeah.
And I think there's the other real image was a group of Antifa folks with rainbow shields that said love on them that were beating the hell out of some guy and some Hispanic man and his son. And that they I don't even think they were part of whatever, they had like wandered within the vicinity of the whatever the rally was. And you're watching these black clad, black masked guys with rainbow shields that, with hearts that say love on them, like mashing this family into the ground. And, you know, it's like, I don't know, just because if you paint the word love or tolerance on something, it doesn't make it so, right? It ends up being sort of a 1984 kind of effect, right?
Yeah, it's just the French Revolution. This is not particular to our age. This is what happened in the French Revolution. They're just painting love on stuff and chopping 10,000 priests' heads off. They're claiming the light away from Catholic darkness, and with that, they're you know, destroying formal and final causation from the university. But it was a reign of terror. They just wrote love on everything. It was a smiley face with a little Hitler mustache. But see, what I think, why I think the narrative form is so important to the left's Alinskyite tactic of always painting itself as the underdog. Yes, I agree with everything you said. That's a good answer. It's an aesthetic appeal. I think there's a very finite arithmetic that generates the expectations of the hoi polloi. The hoi polloi will accept and embrace in its stories, its narrative format, a certain amount of, just call them like 10 units of measurement of underdog sort of coming up. Mm-hmm. Not comeuppance, but you know, Rocky starts out, he's a, you know, a thumb breaker, and then he works for extra money at a meat packing plant. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, by the end of Rocky One, he comes up, let's say 10 points of dignity to now he just, you know, took a split decision, took a decision to the cards with the world heavyweight champion, Apollo Creed. Then in two, he'll go from tying him and shocking the world to actually beating him. Right. Sorry, spoiler alert. If some of you Luddites out there haven't seen Rocky One and Two yet, but the point is, so the hoi polloi, you know, the 90% will accept this and applaud it and say, okay, well, we like about 10 units of measurement of rise from our protagonists. Therefore, if you want to gain power, if one wants to gain power and wants the public to smile on it, like the homosexuals, the feminists, the whatever, transgenderist, whatever it is next, people that want to make it with their cat that's coming around the corner, mm-hmm. they have to pitch themselves as Rocky at the beginning of Rocky One, not Rocky at the beginning of Rocky Three, when he's cocky and he's you know, losing to Clubber Lang. You know what I mean? I don't know why I'm so full of Rocky analogies today, but you have to pitch yourself down here so that where the public thinks you are is, oh, you just got your dignity back. So after 10 units of measurement of rise, you're now just here. Whereas what the left's always doing, they're the bullies, right? They're the ones that have stormed all the institutions and they run all the things. So they're just getting 10 units of measurement more of power every new movement or every new micro movement, the way LGBT became a new micro movement of transgender, right? So they're just getting 10 more units of power each time. And they're still saying that they're the underdog. The underdog is the straight white male Christian. And because they hold the most important institution of power, the media, right? They could keep telling these stories because they hold both the news and the entertainment media. And now they hold the sports media and they just keep repackaging this tale like, oh, we're the poor underdog. It's like, no, you're Rocky in Rocky Three. You're not Rocky at the beginning of Rocky One anymore. You're the muscle.
Yep.
But the public keeps falling for it. My big thing is, when will the public stop falling for it? It's so obviously wrong.
I think when I think that the gender stuff will take things. It might have already have done so. Can put in that for a second. Can I just go back to something that's connected to this narrative arc thing?
Of course.
So I think that in addition to that, there is, you know, the presumed like Whig interpretation of history, that there's this Hegelian telos to the unfolding of history that is just built into, you could call it the moral progress narrative, right? And that humanity is on this trajectory of more and more equal rights claims to more and more oppressed groups. And that would explain something like the founding of the country and the ending of slavery and then women's rights, gay rights, trans rights, etc. Right. So then each of these new underdog claims, they can help themselves to that Whig interpretation of history and just say, this is the next vista of moral progress. And if you challenge that at all, then it's just, then now we're in the Mott and Bailey problem where they'll just back up and they'll scoop in a prior rights claim and say, well, you know, don't you think the founding of the country was good? Don't you think the ending of slavery is good? And you can say yes, but the problem is, and Catholics can say yes to that, but the reason behind it isn't in virtue of a Whig interpretation of history. It's in virtue of regard for our basic dignity in regard to, for subsidiarity, in regard for our free agency. And so I think that if Catholics and conservatives can say, yes, the founding of the country was legitimate and the ending of slavery was legitimate, but it, not in virtue of this unfolding Whig interpretation of history, but in virtue of classic natural law Thomistic reasons, then it prevents that this kind of runaway slide where each group just takes the baton and helps themselves to that next iteration of rights claims, which at this point, the LGBTQ plus, like plus, right? Plus rights claims. Like, so what are your rights claims? Anything. I endorse anything. I believe anything, you know, whatever is the pluses, I'm for that. And it's like, I think that's reason to rethink our first principles.
Yeah, you said that really well. I like that a lot because Catholics are at a point in history now, 2021, where they're unsure how they should feel about the American experiment. And that's a big part of what I do. It's my first book. And your parsing of the way that we can endorse the founding of the country without endorsing this progressive evolution of history that is sometimes behind, more often than not, behind the Whig interpretation of history was really nice. Look, Michael, will you give a couple of your quick plugs? Because we're out of time here. You had a really nice parting shot that I think enables disenchanted or dispirited academics to go out on an up note. So give us your plugs, anything you want to plug, and give us also your parting shot. I'd love to hear it.
Awesome. Thanks. Yeah. So I got a lot of stuff coming out. So you can find me at michaelroblog.com. The 2-day Patriotic Men's Conference, you can find at christianveteransunited.com. And we got some great speakers there coming to that. Tim will be part of it virtually or live, depending, you know, in some capacity. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And some other, you know, it's a combination of, Christian men and veterans and leaders, and to talk about areas of faith, family, and flag. So you can get your tickets there virtually or in person. You can find me on Substack. That's where my writing is. And I'm Dr. Michael Robillard or Dr. M. Robillard on Twitter. I just signed up for that the other day or started using it. So I think it's Dr. M. Robillard. And then I have a book coming out with Dr. B.J. Strasser called Outsourcing Duty, the Moral Exploitation of the American Soldier, coming out through Oxford University Press. And that hopefully should be coming out right prior to the 20th anniversary of 9/11. So that's the, you know, what's happening in the queue for stuff I'm coming out with. And just the thing, what I would like to say to any persons that are in academia right now, or any students who are in academia, is that, you know, I realize that it can be very stifling and it can be very scary to find the courage to step up and to say that the emperor has no clothes, but you can do it, and you ought to. If you hear something that is overtly false or contradictory, then go ahead and call it out and demand that the argument be made. And if it's a shaming tactics, then that's not a good argument. And I think that's how we push back on this stuff. It's little by little, argument by argument, moment by moment. It's like reclaim the space of discourse and make your interlocutor state their premises and run the argument clearly. And you don't have to be intimidated. And that's that.
Well said, Michael. Thanks a million for coming on. God bless
you. Thank you for having me.
God bless your work. Yeah, no, this is good stuff. And I'm going to continue working with you. And I hope people go check your stuff out, because what you're saying is really important. And it's the message that center rightists need to hear at this point in history. I'll bring you back on the show and we'll talk about don't go to college. We'll wait a little bit. We'll wait a little bit for that, though.
There you go, friend.
Cool, man. All right. God bless you, people. Keep your head on a swivel. Everyone stay strong, stay tough, keep the faith. Deus vult.
God bless.